This is a special call to action to our listeners to financially support this podcast and spread awareness of the Native Plants Dialogue through exclusive Plant Native Nebraska merch at plant-native-nebraska.myspreadshop.com. Wear our designs in your best effort to convert your friends and neighbors, or just simply look cool. Thank you for your continued support in our quest to help Nebraska plant native. Hello, and welcome to the Plant Native Nebraska podcast. I'm your host, Stephanie Barlman. If you are new to tuning in, this show is for native plant enthusiasts, aspiring gardeners, suburban homeowners, growers, and thinkers anxious to learn more about growing Native American plants and creating habitat for wildlife. If this sounds like you, you've come to the right place. In today's episode, Native Edible Plants Part 3, Nuts, Blossoms, and Fruits, we chat with Bob Henriksen from the Nebraska Statewide Arboretum about rabbit holes, unripe black walnut liqueur, and even more native plants to add to your edible garden. Thanks for listening.
Hey!
Hey, hello.
Well, it's great to have you here again today, Bob. I'm excited because this is a little bit different than the stuff we've been covering so far.
No doubt.
Now, really quick, in case someone's jumping in and they haven't already listened to some of our previous conversations, I wanted to give you some time just to mention really quick what you do for the Nebraska Statewide Arboretum. But I also wanted to bring up, because I got this in the mail yesterday, a membership form where people can sign up and actually get a membership to the Statewide Arboretum. And you can help contribute to some of the great things that NSA does. 15 schools got free bloombox gardens. I mean, so much cool stuff is being done right now by the NSA. In the letter, it looks like just last year, the funding to the NSA planted 15,000 plants, trees, and shrubs. Is that right?
Plants in the ground this last year was 45,000.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And that probably, the number you were reading was probably like 3 grants, maybe.
So maybe a little blooper on there. Maybe they thought it included everything and it actually didn't. It's bigger.
Yeah. Wow. Just the trees alone was the number I'm seeing here is 4,900.
If you guys didn't happen to get this in the mail, you can go online to plantnebraska.org and find the details because it's a really great program. And then if you ever shop at any of the sales that the NSA has at their greenhouse or the spring affair event, you get a discount on the stuff that you're going to buy anyway. So I want to bring that up.
So yeah, really the easiest way to connect with us is obviously to become a member. Then you learn about all these cool events that are coming up and you stay connected. And of course you support a great organization that's literally planting Nebraska because we are all over the state. Mm-hmm. Gosh, of Nebraska's 300 plus communities, we've at least reached, I think the numbers at like 250 that have received pass through grants from us to do landscaping projects. When you plant trees in a community, plant pollinator gardens, prairie gardens, things like that, it shows the community and the citizens of the community, we don't plan on going anywhere because trees are all about hope, right? Trees are all about the future. And a well-landscaped town, as you drive through, says, huh, you know, I think I could make a home here. I think I could live here. Mm. You know, it just sends a message.
Well, and it's a gift that keeps on giving, you know, like some of these trees that are really long-lived, they live 100 years or so.
Right, exactly.
Bob, tell us a little bit about what you do there.
Yeah, so my job is I'm the horticulturist here at the Statewide Arboretum, kind of the jack of all trades type thing when you wear a horticulturist hat. And that's just so I mainly am a grower. And so I grow perennials, trees, shrubs, native grasses, things like that. We order plants in as well to meet the demand. And we're building a new greenhouse. Yay. And thanks to our supporters for stepping up to the plate and getting that built. Not built yet. So it's making me a little nervous with November breathing is down the neck, but I don't start production until late February anyway. So we're good to go for now.
Yeah, I heard about that new greenhouse just yesterday. Now, because I remembered the one you guys were using before was a bit of a drive, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yeah, I was up near Mead, Nebraska. University has property up there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So today we're talking about native nuts, blossoms, and fruits, which just sounds so fun already. And I looked some of these up in case anyone's wondering where I gleaned some of my info I'm providing. I've been reading Daniel Mormon's Native American Ethnobotany, which is a tome if you ever saw one. But it's really nice because there's so many detailed pieces of information on all these different plants, whether it's medicinal uses or food uses, that, you know, basically what's been historically done by Native American tribes. So it's really, really great information. If you're nerdy about it, like we are, it's going to take you all winter long to get through it. And even then you might still have some more to pick through. We're just talking about edible uses in this series, but maybe in the future, our podcast will also explore a lot of the medicinal stuff too.
Amen. Well, you know, and you bring up a good point, Stephanie. Anything we're talking about today, culinarily speaking, I mean, food is medicine. That's where the statement comes from, right? Is we all need to eat more healthy. We all know that, right? You know, if you start including native fruits and nuts in your diet, my oh my, you know, and then, like you said, fall down that rabbit hole, learning more about, you know, are these things good for you?
Yeah.
And then getting creative in how you harvest and store them and use them, you know, because you can only make so much jelly, right?
And I mean, this is a good inspiration to plant these things. You know, if some of these things intrigue you and you've got room for a tree or you've got room for a large, you know, fruit producing shrub, this is a good incentive to get those things in your garden so that in a few years time, you can have some food stuff to harvest. And it not only is it free because you're growing it yourself, but then you get all the other habitat benefits that it provides and things like that. So I put together a little list today. I tried not to go too overboard.
Yeah, that's tough.
But the first one on my list is American hazelnut. So Corylus americana. Mm-hmm. I hope I'm saying that correctly. It looks like the nut meats are the thing that are harvested. So the Iroquois, I read, they crushed and mixed the nut meats with bread. Or maybe they mixed it into hominy or mashed potatoes even, which sounded intriguing. And then I read that the Ponca, Winnebago, and Omaha tribes used this as a body for soup. So it looks like it's a pretty versatile nut. Could you tell us what you know about it?
Yeah, it is a versatile nut. And you know, as you were talking about people planting these things in your yard, folks, we were talking about planting these things in your yard back in the 80s. You know, and if you go even further back in time when people were planting shrub borders, it was like a row of lilacs, right? Or they did a row of those spireas, or, you know, now they're doing rows of hydrangeas. That has replaced that with, you know, the hydrangeas are everywhere. But now there's kind of a little bit more of a movement so you can have a shrub border, i.e., you bet you can't be afraid of big plants. You know, these American hazelnut, for example, does have a potential to get, oh gosh, I've seen them up there 15 feet, but I've also seen shrubs that stayed around 6 to 8 for many, many decades. So that kind of puzzles me. Why do some stay shorter than others? I think it depends on how much water they're getting and, you know, how rich the soil is, if it's a tough site, you know, that type of thing. But the thing about the American hazelnut is it's so tough. I mean, this thing can grow in full sun to pretty much full shade. I've seen it out in our native woods, mainly in the southeastern part of the state. So you'll find it at places like, you know, Nebraska City area south to Richardson in Falls City, and then a little bit to the east, but not much. Again, tough shrub. That's one reason to grow it. It's a thicket shrub. So it's going to have multiple stems on it, not a single stem, but multiple stems. So it forms a nice dense thicket. So you'll get songbirds nesting in it. So it's good habitat.
Nice.
And the fall color is what I like most about it. It's fall color. It's one of the first to color up like the sumac. You just don't see it in the road ditches like you do sumac, right? So it's not one that's just all over the place. So we got to change that planting in our landscapes.
Yeah.
But the fall color is usually a kaleidoscope. I've seen them in shadier conditions get more, greenish purple, not a loud fall color. But once you get about in the full sun, I've seen yellow, orange, and red all in the same plant, kind of a kaleidoscope, if you will. And really pretty. And again, one of the first to color up. So it says hello fall, a day like today, it's brisk mm-hmm. out there today. So we're all kind of reminded it's right here. So that's one attribute. Its stems are attractive, even in the wintertime, I think, as a shrub. And it has what we call catkin flowers. And catkins are, those dangly, people describe them as dangling tarantulas, dangling from the bare branches in the wintertime. I don't know if it quite looks like a tarantula up in your tree, but I've heard them also described as tinsel hanging up in the branches. Mm-hmm. They're cool. Just if you're interested, just look up images of catkin flowers on hazelnuts. But anyway, in the wintertime, they're kind of short and stubby. But then in the spring, early spring, we're talking March, late February, March, depending on the spring. So it's a harbinger of spring to say it's here or right around the corner, at least. These things elongate. And Stephanie, I've seen the catkins elongate to around, 4 to 5 inches. So then it really does look like tinsel. And if you shake the branches, you can see the pollen come off.
Love it.
So it's a wind pollinated plant. So you need more than one to produce nuts. And I've asked the fellow who's a hazelnut expert here in Nebraska with the Nebraska Forest Service, Aaron Clare, who's working on hybrid hazelnut that we can talk about here. He said, a lot of people don't have room for three hazelnuts. I told him, can I plant three of them semi-close together and they just come up, become one big unit? And he said, for sure, 3 feet apart, something like that, right? Mm-hmm. But to get to its full size, you'd space them more like 8-10 feet apart, right? They would certainly fill that space. Mm. So you got your spring catkin flowers and then I think attractive summer foliage. And then later on in the year, it'll form these clusters of fruit. But honestly, Stephanie, growing them in landscapes, the birds usually beat the humans to them because the squirrels will take them green. I've heard from people, but yeah, it's a very nutritious nut, high in oil. Native Americans utilizing it for soup, no doubt it's a good nut for soup.
Well, it makes sense then if they're small, makes sense that they would crush the nut meat that was inside and mix it with other things. Like it was more of a supplemental food as opposed to like a standalone sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Just worth harvesting, but not in huge abundance,
Gotcha. And, obviously like you noted, the animals might beat us to it. So it might be more of like, I'm lucky if I get some.
but I think, that's one of the better uses for it. Hazelnut cake. I've made it before. It is the bomb. And Kay Young has a recipe in her book, which we often refer to on this podcast.
Oh, yeah.
For hazelnut cake. So in other words, if you buy them at the store, hopefully down the road here, folks, as the Forest Service's hazelnut crop grows and they're harvesting, they'll make these available to local stores. But stay tuned for that.
Yeah, for sure. The next one is kind of a similar situation. So shag bark hickory. Is it pronounced Caria? Caria ovata?
Yeah, Caria. Uh-huh. Caria.
And it's the same kind of situation where historically tribes would use the nut meats and mix into bread crushed. I read several tribes used hickory chips to make sugar. Do you know anything about that? Sounds like a painstaking process.
Hickory chips?
Yeah. I don't know if it was like a boiling process or...
Yeah, So another thing folks can look up, and you're not going to hurt the trees. So shagbark hickory goes native in Wabunzi and Indian Cave. And I have some where I harvested them today. There's nut trees here on campus that were planted as a nut orchard. And the shellbark hickories will also exfoliate. So we call this exfoliating bark. If you Google images of shagbark hickory, you'll see that bark and that weird, platy, shaggy bark that's basically not quite even attached to the tree, right? And you can kind of break that bark off without damaging the tree. You don't want to necessarily, you know, pull it away from the tree and pull the fresh bark off, right? Mm. You just kind of snap it off and then you break them into 1-inch pieces. So that's the chips you're reading about, hickory bark chips. You take it home and you scrub it really well. After you wash and dry and break them into chips, you bake them in the oven, and that kills any bacteria or anything, right? So you're baking them in the oven at like 350 degrees for however long, an hour or something, maybe not that long, but that starts to get the oils going in the bark. Mm. And then you boil it. So it's a process.
Yeah.
And then add sugar to it to make it sweet, and then crank up the heat so it becomes syrupy, you know, for that syrup temperature. So like making a simple syrup. Hickories have an awesome history too. If we have time here, I'd like to talk about here eventually a Cherokee dish that was very well known. It's a hickory nut soup. So if you just Google hickory nut soup, folks, and I have a ball in the freezer as we speak that I made last year. And it's called a canucci ball. So you pound it. Gosh, see, so that's what I'm thinking they did with the hazelnuts. They probably pounded shell and all. And there's a way when you cook it that, to separate out, because the nut meat gets pound ground up, you know, so there's really no body to the nut meat anymore. And then so if you pound it that way and you cook it, the shells sink to the bottom. And the hickory nut meat becomes part of the soup. So then you can strain it out that way, you see. So you're not, you know, because I think as Anglo-Saxons envision, geez Louise, what'd they do? Spend hours cracking those things? You know, no, they had easy methods to do this. And the canucci ball is the same way. The challenge we have most anybody listening is, where the heck am I going to get hickory nuts? You know, you can order them online, but they're expensive, right? And so very few people. Hickory nuts. The one I was harvesting today is called shellbark hickory, also called king nut hickory. I think, in my opinion, is the king of nuts. And there's a lot of different nut trees out there, folks. Why is it the king? To me, it's a pecan met a black walnut, and they had a baby. And the baby was, as far as the flavor goes, it's unique, it's earthy, it's, you know, a delicious nut, first of all. So we need to have those grown all over the place in public spaces as well as people's landscapes. The challenge, again, is you need more than one to cross-pollinate with the tree, because it'll form nuts, but the nuts are hollow. They won't pollinate. So you need a cross-pollination occurring. But if everybody would have a hickory tree in their yard, we'd have cross-pollination all over the city, yeah. Right? That's my dream. Man, and shellbark, I'm telling you, it is a big nut. We're talking this, you know, once you take the husk off an inch across, shagbark's half the size of a shellbark. And the reason I'm touting shellbark, Stephanie, is because when we think of hickory, everybody thinks of shag. Appropriately so, the shaggy bark of a shagbark hickory is native to Nebraska, that and bitternut. And shagbark is native, again, to the southeast quadrant, kind of three counties, Richardson, Nemaha, gets up into Omaha. There's native shagbarks in the Omaha, in the city itself, in some of the wild areas there in Omaha. It's harder to harvest.
What's the nativity on the shell bark? Because I didn't look that one up today. I looked up the shagbark.
Yeah.
Is the shellbark native?
It is not quite native to Nebraska, but man drew borders, plants didn't. Yeah, if you go south of Kansas about a half hour and just over the border into Missouri, it's Nevada, Missouri. And then in southeast Kansas, I've actually seen the trees down there, native shellbark. So it gets into southeast Kansas, just south of Kansas City, and points east, you know, kind of the Ozarks. It's an Ozark tree down in Kentucky, Tennessee, yada, yada.
Okay.
But we found it's perfectly hardy in Nebraska, certainly from the Platte River south and from Falls City west to Kearney. I would not hesitate to plant a shellbark. But I grew up in Dodge, Nebraska, which is just north and west of Fremont, about 30 minutes. And we planted shellbark and shagbark and bitternut in Dodge Park. and all three of them are doing just fine.
Mm-hmm.
The more the merrier. It's an awesome tree, worthy of growing. They have a reputation as being slow growing. That's one of the reasons you don't see them in the trade. And they have a tremendous tap root. So they're very drought tolerant because of that. And once you get them in the landscape, they take off, you know, I mean, they'll grow a foot, foot and a half a year and do just fine. So anyway, back to they're incredibly nutritious, have a lot of the good fat that we're looking for. But this hickory soup recipe, this kanuchi that I made is like a pureed nut soup. And then they would add things to it like hominy, maybe some sweet potato, things like that, you know. Mm. And it's rich. It's nutty. It was very much a tradition. And there's still some indigenous folks, specifically the Cherokee, that are keeping that tradition alive and still make kanuchi today.
Nice. It's really interesting. It sounds like a great fall soup. So it's kind of perfect that we're talking about this recipe right now because it's very seasonally relevant.
Exactly. Very seasonally relevant.
Interesting. I'll look into that some more because I thought that was cool. And I mean, these nuts from the hickory, they can be eaten plain, right? Like with honey or just plain eaten raw.
Oh. Oh, for sure. Yeah, you can eat them raw. What you need to do with any nut is you cure it. You'd have to do this with hazelnuts, black walnuts, whatever you're collecting. You want to cure it. If you just pull it off the tree, take the husk off, crack it, and eat it like that, you're going to kind of shrug your shoulders and go, yeah, whatever. There's a lot of moisture in that nut yet. So curing it just means drying it. Mm. And because the nut you buy in the store has already been cured, meaning it's been dried. And most nuts, you know, a month is safe. So you keep it in a dry location, you know, 70 plus degrees, 70, 80 degrees if you can. You know, I'll put it on the back patio in the fall just to make sure and cover it with something because squirrels will literally chew a hole in whatever you have to get access to those things. I've seen it done. If I have a wimpy container, they'll chew a hole right through it. Anyway. Yeah, you let them cure. And then if I cracked that nut and had you try it, you'd go, oh, I see what you mean. It concentrates the oils, concentrates the flavors.
Mm-hmm.
And then roasted hickory nuts, Stephanie, you can top on anything. I mean, you could top it on a salad. You could top it on, you know, any sort of crunch you want in that recipe you're making, right? Just like any nut.
That sounds great.
And hickory nut pie, I'm known for my hickory nut pie by my friends. And they say it's the best ever. And I like making a triple nut pie. So that's a triple nut is pecan, black walnut, and hickory nut pie, all three combined. So you just follow a pecan pie recipe and just use a third of the pecans. And I have all three in my freezer as we speak.
Now,
from last year.
I have not yet become familiar with black walnut being edible to us. I know that squirrels love black walnut, right?
Oh man.
But I didn't know we could eat them. That's cool.
So I don't know if did you want to talk about black walnuts next?
Sure. Yeah, let's just throw it in there.
Oh my, Stephanie, because it's a rabbit hole plant you need to get to know up and down, in and out, because black walnut, like the hickory, like the hazelnut, is overlooked and unutilized. Most people just kind of thumb their nose up to a black walnut, right? Oh, it's got juglone. It kills all these plants underneath it. And no, only non-natives. Most all native plants have that have grown naturally amongst black walnuts and around them don't have a problem with juglone.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen many plants growing underneath walnuts that have no problem with them. So don't let that worry you. So you can actually harvest a walnut later on in the year while the husks are still green, and you can dent a walnut. It's ready to go. So I can harvest it and wait. You want to not wait until it turns black, because those husks have a ton of tannins in them, and those tannins will get into the nut meat and make it very bitter, because most people are either you love them or you hate them for black walnuts. I happen to love them, but I've also learned from the Nut Growers Association that I've been harvesting them too late. You want to get them when the husks are green, turning to yellow. Mm. So if you harvest these husks early, or the walnut early, and you just roll it under your foot, that husk comes right off the nut. And then you have to clean the nuts and cure them and access the nut meat after that. The nut meat, if I remember right, has more beneficial carbohydrates than any other nut on the planet. So it's incredibly good for you. That's something you could forage right in your own town. And believe you and me, if you knock on a neighbor's door and ask them if they mind if you harvested black walnuts, they'd say, please do.
Yeah.
Because most people don't know that they make an amazing product. There's another one that I've made before that mine's going right now. It's called Nocino, and that's N-O-C-I-N-O. So if you know, does that sound Italian? Yes, it is. Nocino. And Nocino is an Italian liqueur, and that's made from green walnuts. So in the summertime, these little developing walnuts are only about an inch. And I challenge you, Stephanie, to pluck one off a tree in the summertime in early June, early to mid-June, and smell it. It smells lemony, very citrusy almost. And they would basically take those green walnut holes and tincture them in vodka or pure grain alcohol or something like that. And because black walnuts stain everything black, sure enough, this tincture turns very black in color. And you let the green walnuts sit in there for, oh gosh, I think it's up to a year. No, it's only like 6 weeks. You take them out and then you add things like coffee beans, cinnamon, lemon zest, and add that for a number of weeks. And then you strain that out and then you let it sit. I think it takes a year, maybe two. A good Nocino will be resting for 2 years and then it becomes a liqueur. And the reason it rests is the tannins mellow over time. So it has a rich flavor. And you can actually look up recipes, like it's a high-end, high-dollar thing to those top, wow, those high-end bars in New York City. There's a great website I've told you about before on this called Forager Chef. Mm-hmm. He's got a great recipe for that.
Wow. And, I'll look that up.
Yeah. So it's basically a bitter, and bitters are used. What do you call a fancy drink maker? They have a title. I can't remember what they're called, but they will use just a little bit of bitters in a fancy drink to enhance it. And that's what Nocino is used for.
Okay. Yeah. And I actually, it's interesting that we ended up talking about black walnut when maybe we didn't originally plan to, because I've been studying native dye stuff. So native plant material to use to make dye stuff and dye, you know, basically any kind of fabric or material, or if you got a crafting project where you want to make a DIY prairie tablecloth or whatnot. And I read that you can harvest the green hull of the black walnut, and it acts as both a mordant and a dye because of the tannins. You know, that's why wine stains, you know, when you spill wine on your shirt, it's hard to get the stain out because the wine actually has a lot of tannins in it. And the tannin is what makes it adhere so much to the fabric and also makes it a really potent dye.
Amen. Doesn't fade, right?
Yeah. That's fascinating. So another versatile tree, and maybe one that people view negatively, that maybe should have a second look taken at it for all its usefulness. You know, it's a plant you can experiment with too and see what kind of uses you enjoy getting out of it. The next one, let's see, what did I have planned next? So I have written down Eastern Redbud, which you can use both pods and the flower blossoms from it. I just love this plant for its looks to begin with. It's an early bloomer. It's a great understory tree. So this can grow in a dappled shade sort of situation, no problem. It's a very stately ornamental tree, which explains why there's so many cultivars in the trade of it. But I do not know personally very much about its edibility. So maybe you can fill in there.
Yeah, sure. And honestly, about all I've done is snacked on the flowers before. But the flowers, you know, everybody's going, you want me to eat those beautiful flowers? Well, usually there's enough to go around, right? And getting them young, because redbud flowers will persist for quite a while, right? Unlike a crab apple, it seems to, like, you know, take a week. So you can get them in the bud stage, believe it or not. And sometimes you've seen red buds where those flower clusters are right on the trunk itself. Maybe you've seen that before too. Mm-hmm. But observe red bud flowers up close next time when it's blooming. And I challenge you to say, oh, wait, Stephanie and Bob are saying they're edible. Okay, here goes nothing, and give it a try. So you can basically just break off a cluster, pop it into your mouth and try it. I've heard it described as, you know, it's nothing exciting, mind you. It's like eating a green bean, but yet it has this citrusy kind of aftertaste, right? It's where you're like, oh, no, not bad. So you'll sample a few more. So again, you can use it, you know, to color up a dish, right? Say you're having a salad, you're having guests over, and, you know, or just your own meal, whatever. You know, it's not like you're going to harvest, you know, a gallon bucket of these and utilize them. However, you sure could. I've not done this before, but like you would do capers. What are capers, folks?
Oh, yeah.
Capers are just flower buds. I don't know the plant that they use to make capers that we all love, but capers are expensive in the store. You can make capers out of red bud buds. So if you just type in red bud flower capers, you will see a recipe on how to make that. And it's just basically a vinegar, right? You're
yeah, pickling them, basically.
Pickling them, exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's the best way to preserve them. Yeah. And then, as you said, those pods then form after the flowers. So, okay, you can use part of that harvest season just for the flowers, right? And then later on, it develops those, looks like a snap pea, doesn't it? It looks like a pea flowers. Those, I've never tried them raw. Quite honestly, folks, I've never cooked with them yet. But it's on my bucket list. You want to get the pods when they're young. And because I think when they get a little older, they're tougher and chewier, certainly still edible, but not necessarily palatable. So I do have to read up a little bit more on the young seed pods. But apparently they're very nutritious too. So, another thing I forgot too, the leaves. So, okay. So first you got the flowers before the pods are forming, you got the leaves coming on, right? And those leaves coming on, so if you notice a plant when the leaves are emerging in the spring, once the leaves are all the way leafed out, it has that dark green color, but the tips of the branches often have a leaf that almost looks shiny and translucent, right? If you put your finger behind it, you could see through the leaf. Do you know what I'm talking about, Stephanie, when I say that?
I don't, but that intrigues me.
You'll see that on a lot of trees. You'll see that on lindens, for example. Linden leaves are edible, for example, but you want to get them when they're at that translucent stage because they get bitter later on in the season. If a leaf tasted good all year long, everything would defoliate them. So plants put bitter compounds in them, so you don't want to eat as much of it.
You're saying before the flower buds form, basically when the new growth is being put on and we have these very young leaves,
exactly,
when it's in this translucent leaf stage, the leaves are edible. That's what you're saying,
right? Exactly. Bingo. Yeah, they're great in salads. Yeah, and salads, you would use them, or you could like a finished thing in a stir fry. And as the leaves grow, they're better suited for soups and broths, meaning you can still use them, but you would just use them in a cooked dish like that where you're utilizing. And there again, I can't tell you what they taste like, right? Do they just taste green? Again, is just, it's one of those things on my bucket list. Oh, and one other thing about the flowers, you can dry the flowers and they're beautiful in things like granola over yogurt.
Nice.
and topped on deviled. So picture you have dried flowers and you're going to a potluck in the wintertime and you're making deviled eggs. I'm seeing this recipe online where they top the deviled eggs with those dried pink flowers. and some sprinkles of chives.
No
and it
way.
looks so like totally pretty.
I love deviled eggs, so anything to make fancy deviled eggs.
So I'm going to have to harvest and dry a bunch because the flowers stay pink and then use them. How cool is that?
Yeah, and I'd imagine, you know, we have a dehydrator. So I'd imagine if you, you know, you collect the little buds or the flowers or whatnot and you dry them, they'll last quite a while dry. I don't know how long, but quite a while.
For sure.
Yeah.
You know, you could certainly make red bud jelly as well. There's a recipe online for red bud jelly, red bud cordial. Again, that's made with the flowers.
Yeah, wonderful. Oh, well, even more reasons to have a red bud because it's a beautiful, versatile plant and has endless uses, apparently. So another reason to have one in your garden.
So we talked about the pods, but get this, we're not done yet. The seeds. Okay. So later on in the season, when the pods turn brown and you see them like right now dangling up in the tree, like sometimes they'll be thick on a tree, Stephanie, but they're not always filled. You know, you got to kind of check, does it have the little seed in there? And the seed that's inside those pods, sometimes there'll be three, sometimes four seeds per pod. And what I do is just pulse it in the blender and the seeds come free of the pods. And the pods float and the seeds sink, so you can separate them very easily. And then you have all those seeds. Well, why do I want those seeds? They're the size of a lentil, so you can cook them up that way and use them like you would use lentils. You can grind them into a powder and use them as that. And get this, I've read they are 25% protein. And so if you know red buds, birds will eat those seed pods. They'll go after those seed pods. And for a reason, they're after that protein rich.
No way. Okay. Well, that's surprising. I didn't know that.
Right. Isn't that
that's
wild?
Amazing.
I didn't either. That's, you know, when I started digging into doing these talks on wild edibles, you know, I would run down a rabbit hole every darn plant. I would look up because I'd be like, I heard red bud flowers are edible. And then I was like, the pods are too. No, wait, the seeds are too. Oh, and the leaves are too. It never stops.
You know, the more we go down this, I mean, it's like, I'm almost angry. I almost feel like it's not fair that I don't have more time or like two more of me. Cause I would just send one out to like endlessly forage all the time and just bring home spoils. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because you're right on. There's not a day that goes by that you can't forward something.
I know. And, you know, a lot of times for us gardeners, you know, a day goes by very quickly because we're trying to do so many, you know, we've got too many things going on. And so by the time we get to something, it's already too late. Now, this next one we can talk about. Planes and twist spine prickly pear. I know absolutely nothing about prickly pear. So I'm kind of relying on what I've read and on you for information. So in this book, this ethnobotany book that I've read, I saw that the Navajo would dry the prickly pear fruit, or they would even eat it raw. And I read that the Cheyenne would dry the pulp and use it to thicken soups and stews. That's for the plains prickly pear. The Navajo, I guess, use the twist spine prickly pear. Fascinating that a prickly pear is native to Nebraska, but even cooler that it's got edible fruit.
Oh yeah, you know, from what I understand, the fruit is tasty. You can pluck them off. They have what those little tiny cactus spines on a cactus are called glaucids, G-L-O-C-H-I-D-S. Glaucids are these tiny little hair-like spines that are annoying if you get them stuck to your fingers because they're hard to see, right? And they still hurt and stick you. But if you can grab those little fruits, and the fruits are very pretty. If you Google prickly, big root prickly cactus fruits, you'll see they turn a nice rich red color, like a purplish red. And if you cut those open and look inside, it's a very pretty purple, kind of glistening with moisture. And you just kind of suck the pulp and the seeds out all together. And just kind of like you would a watermelon, you're working that juice around the seeds and then you spit the seeds out, right? And It's like a strawberry meats. It's hard to describe. It's a unique flavor, but it was just a snack item mostly. I'm sure you could harvest a bunch to dry. Nowadays, foragers will harvest prickly pear fruit. Gosh, I've read where you can make wine, and my wife Pat and I haven't done that yet. But now that I just said that out loud, I'm thinking, wait, let this be the year. I might know where some prickly pear fruit is waiting for my and calling my name before this freeze. Anyway, yeah. So you can just rub those glaucids off with a butter knife. They come off really easy. So you're not, and then you just split the thing open and suck out the innards. And it's worth doing that because if you're on the dry prairie and it's a hot day or it's a fall day and there's no water around, you could suck the juice out of that fruit and satisfy your craving for water. That's for sure, because that's what a cactus is. But another thing folks need to turn themselves on to if they haven't yet is the pads. Prickly pear pads were certainly used as well. And what you were referring to for thickening soups, if you cut open a pad and you see the juice in there and you touch that juice and rub your fingers together, it's very slimy, mucilaginous, we call that, as a plant compound like aloe vera. Our friends from Mexico have introduced us all to this, and certainly more Southwestern tribes in the United States is nopales. And nopales are still eaten today. If you go to the grocery store, you'll often see prickly pear cactus pads. Haven't you seen cactus pads in the grocery store before, Stephanie?
I haven't.
Yeah, here in Lincoln, where I shop, Super Saver, depending on the part of town, they'll always have cactus pads or nopales. Okay. And I had a young Mexican kid work for me one summer. So we were chatting about nopales, and so he said his favorite thing with cactus pads is a popular torta or a sandwich that you would make in Mexico, and that's grilled cactus pads, and then you cut them into strips. You put them in some good bread with Mexican cheese, and you melt that together and make basically our version of a grilled cheese sandwich. And oh my, I've made that before. It's really good.
So you're saying we could essentially make a prickly pear grilled cheese sandwich,
right, out of the pads. So now you're all picturing, wait a minute, but the pads are covered with spines, and you want to choose prickly pear because the spines are kind of concentrated on the outer ring, and you can literally use the scissors as you're holding it in the pad with the tongs and cut that outer edge, which has most of the spines. You throw them in boiling water for however long the recipe calls for. You pull them out of the boiling water, let them cool, and then you can use a butter knife and those spines just rub right away. And you just basically, so in the store, what you'll see is a pad that's already been cleaned and processed. You know, somebody has done the parboiling to get the spines off. Anyway, you want to cook them for a while because that mucilaginous juice comes out of them. And then it basically tastes like a green bean meets asparagus, I guess. It's but again, another way I've read that they were prepared. So we did this when you have an outdoor fire pit and your fire's starting to go down where you have the white coals, right? You have the white with the red coals and deep. That's when they would often, or they would separate those coals. And they would throw the pads right on there, right on the hot coals. And basically they would blacken and of course the spines would burn away. And then you pull that out of there and you can rub that black right off of there and then cut those into strips and use them in recipes. Man, it is the bomb.
That sounds good. That's definitely going to be one. Now, I mean, prickly pear. Is that something that we could truly grow in a suburban garden? Like what's the kind of garden setting these plants would need?
Yeah, not a doubt you can. I certainly can. And I know or have. Yeah, they're easy to grow here. I think the main thing you need is high and dry, you know, like say you got it under an eave in a hot, nasty south side of your house and it's just baking right there. because they have beautiful flowers. You just have to be cognizant that, you know, don't trip over that area, whatnot. You know, you just have to be smart about it. And they're easy to reduce down in size. I'll just chop away because the grouping of cactus will expand every year, maybe further than you want it to. And I'll just chop it away with the spade or harvest it, however I'm getting rid of it. Because in the spring, you want to harvest those early pads in the spring for nopales. The Plains prickly pear is loaded with spines, so it's often not used for nopales, if that makes sense.
The Plains prickly pear isn't usually used
for that. Simply because it has so many spines on it, it's just too difficult to deal with versus the big root prickly pear. The spines are more concentrated along the outer rim. And Kay Young has recipes in her Wild Seasons book too. So again, high and dry. What I mean by that is a raised bed. Maybe you have a rock garden you're making, and maybe your rock garden's pretty big in size, and you have an area you're devoting to a prickly pear, you know, maybe a 2x2 or a 3x3 foot area where you're like, you know, that's your space. You do your thing. And I've made prickly pear fruit jelly before. It's the prettiest jelly you'll ever make. I mean, we're talking a beautiful red color.
It goes back to not having enough time to do stuff. Cause wouldn't it be cool to have like a modern cookbook with really beautiful, vibrant pictures of all the kinds of stuff we could make with native plants? It's really incredible. Right. Or someone's going to, you know, be inspired, wink, wink, to do this soon and start doing stuff like this. The next plant I wrote down was Saskatoon serviceberry. I was lucky enough to get a tour of, I don't know if you know Steve Roth. Do you know Steve?
Yeah.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yes, he showed me his garden yesterday, and he's got a beautiful little pair of June berries that are growing in his garden. And so we got to talking about June berries, but the Saskatoon is Almelanchier ulnifolia. And it looks like it was a highly valued fruit that would be able to be harvested and were eaten fresh, but were used sometimes by various tribes in pies, puddings, cakes, soups, you name it, it was used. What do you know about this one?
Yeah, it's a plant that has a lot of names. You know, serviceberry is one of them. Up north in Canada, they still call them Saskatoons. And you can even pronounce it like Indian. There's actually, I swear, Saskatchewan was named in honor of the Saskatoon. They still collect them by the bucketfuls up in Canada. I've seen online there's a cafe in a little town in North Dakota called the Juneberry Cafe. And so they use, you could probably find up to 60 different recipes online using the Juneberry. It is a great substitute for blueberry. Not because it tastes like a blueberry, it doesn't. It'll never compare to a blueberry flavor, but we have a difficult time growing blueberries, and it's just as versatile as the blueberry in recipes, dried. So Native Americans would dry it and then pound it with buffalo meat and buffalo fat and other fruits to make pemmican. And pemmican was basically the first energy bar, right? Nowadays, we need energy bars. So you can make your own energy bar using June berries as well. And they dry very well, and they're tasty, dried. But usually for us, they don't get past the other recipe stage. There's not enough to go around. Because my wife, Pat, is a winemaker. And so a lot of my Juneberry harvest now goes to wine. And get this, we've harvested up to 20 pounds before, Stephanie, and that's a lot of picking.
Wow.
And anyway, the best Juneberry is when they turn red to this, they're kind of this bluish purple color. And the first time, if I'm at a tree with somebody and I have them try it, I'll say, don't just eat one. You got to eat at least 8 at a time. Pop them all in your mouth. And that juice, it's just like a fine wine already. It makes a really good wine, by the way.
It's a good selling point.
My favorite and what I'm known for is my Juneberry rhubarb pie. But it's not mine. It's Kay Young's recipe. She's got a recipe in Wild Seasons. I think it's the best pie, period. It is so good, and it's worth growing for that. So what you had talked about to start was the Saskatoon.
Yes.
Amelanchier alnifolia is an easy shrub for us to grow in the landscape. We should all have 6 or 10. It only gets to be around 6 feet tall and maybe 4 to 5 wide. I have seen bigger Saskatoons, but that's a big, happy one. They might end up getting around 8 feet. But bottom line is it's a pretty small shrub. Off of 2 small service berries, Saskatoon service berries, I've harvested enough fruit to make 2 pies. That's around 8 cups, by the way. And that's impressive. Actually, no, it was only 1 small shrub. It wasn't even 2 of them. So it's self-fertile. You don't need 2 to pollinate. Regent. So when you're looking for Saskatoons, more than likely you're going to come across one in the store called Regent, R-E-G-E-N-T. Regent. I'm like, who would name a shrub Regent? What kind of boring name is that? So I actually looked it up, and it was selected near the town of Regent, North Dakota. I'm like, oh, okay. So they named it after, it's a place name. It's not some fancy cultivar. Maybe it's a little shorter than the straight species, but you know, that's why I always harp on people talking about so-called native ours. You've got to learn the history of that plant. This plant was found in nature. Sometimes it's marketing 101, but in this case, Regent definitely wasn't marketing 101 with a name like that. You know what I mean? But anyway, it's a small shrub. Then you can get other service berries, Juneberries, they're also called. I prefer the name Juneberry because it just sounds better. I don't know why. And it's appropriately named. The fruit ripens in June, typically. Anyway, there's one called Shadblow service berry. The Shadblow is more of a small tree form. This one will grow 18 feet. I'm sorry. And multi-stemmed, gorgeous thing, likes to grow in the shadow of tall trees. However, you'll get a better fruit production in full sun. So it prefers, and I've seen it really happy in full sun, especially growing in a wet ditch, a ditch that after a heavy rain, it may have standing water for an hour, but it drains away. Man, are they happy in that semi-moist side of a rain garden. Mm-hmm. You could create a rain garden and have nothing but Shadblow service berry or even the alnifolia in the bottom of it, and they would love that condition because nice. Given droughty conditions like we've had, some people have lost service berries. It is so worth growing, so easy to grow. The fall color of the Shadblow is a pumpkin orange, reddish orange. It's wow. To die for. And Shadblow, I'm again being curious, why would they name a shrub Shadblow?
Yeah.
Well, it or service berry. Well, it blooms typically around the Easter service in certain parts of the country. So hence the name service berry, blooming around Easter time. So then they would recognize that as kind of a harbinger of spring. And then there's one on the trade. Autumn Brilliance is often sold. And there's other cultivars that are tree form. Those are called apple service berries because they are in the apple family. And if you look at a little service berry fruit, they kind of look like a miniature apple. They don't taste like one, mind you. But there's a little bit of an apple hint. I get that when I taste the fruit. It's hard to describe the flavor when you tell people what they taste like. Anyway, so Autumn Brilliance is a good fruit producer, but oftentimes Autumn Brilliance, when you're purchasing one, you have a whole lot of tree in a little bitty pot. So the tree struggles because it's pot bound. And then I've had them up and die on people. And they're like, what's wrong with my service berry? Was it the drought? And I'm like, well, I bet if we dug that thing up, we'd find out it had a compromised root system. I've seen it happen again and again. That being said, I know a friend that planted an Autumn Brilliance. 5 years later, you could still move that tree because that root system just did not connect. And I was like, and I was touting the service berry, and she was all disappointed that it hasn't produced fruit in 5 years. And said, well, all I can think of that we do is we cut that main stem back because I'm seeing sprouts come up from the base, and we'll just let it be a multi-stemmed thicket thing. Fast forward 5 years later, the thing was like, I don't know, it just shot up out of the ground after that. It was solid. It rooted down. I don't know how that happened, but it did. And we had a nice service berry shrub, multi-stemmed after that. So Autumn Brilliance is a good one. Just get the smallest tree in the largest pot.
Smallest tree in the largest pot. And I know that you are a grower. So, you know, this might be a good time to just quickly bring up, you know, if you go to a nursery and say, you know, someone's inspired by our talk today and they go out and they buy a service berry and they pull it out of the pot and sure enough, it's pot bound, which means the roots are basically wrapping circularly around the plant. If you leave it like that, there's a good chance that that plant is basically going to kill itself because the roots are just going to smother everything and have nowhere really to go. Because we want the roots to go down into the ground, or, you know, some things, the roots grow more out horizontally. We don't want them wrapped around themselves. So if someone hypothetically were to go to a nursery, they get a service berry, they bring it home, they take it out of the pot and they say, oh crap, it's pot bound. What is the correct way someone could fix this situation before they put that plant in the ground?
Oh man, that's the $1 million question, you know, and I know some tree experts that would say, well, you wouldn't. So if you got a Autumn Brilliance, for example, and you see a thicker root, so maybe a root, you pull it out of the pot and the roots you can see on the outside of that ball are maybe as thick as your pinky, or even as thick as your index finger, right? Sometimes, and it's circling around that pot. I'll take that root back where it started circling and cut it back to where it was coming out and turning. You know, it's called a chain hook, where that root is, you know, hooking where it came in contact with the pot. So if you cut it right at that J, then the new roots that developed won't be turned, because what happens is that root, as it's turning around, it gets locked into place. So even by you severing it right there, it's not going to automatically come out from that cut, if that makes sense. Basically, it's junk, but sometimes you gotta do what you gotta do, right? So if you can cut those bigger roots away at J hook where it's turning, then you're like, oh, wait a minute, I'm removing a lot of roots on that plant. And once I cut it, do I pull it away? I'll just cut it where it J hooks and then I'll cut it again. I'm not trying to tear it away from the whole ball, because then I'm going to tear away other roots. Other research is showing they're literally taking a tree saw and they're sawing the outside of that ball all the way around. And I'm like, ah, that can't be good. I mean, geez Louise, that's putting a root system all the way around. So I can't advocate that either. That's why I say get the smallest plant in the largest pot, because that has the best chance of not being compromised.
That is a easy way of going about it, I think. That's the most sensible, easy way to advise people.
Yeah. Be willing to buy and plant a shrub smaller. That's what you have to be willing to do, because growers, they struggle to get you something 2-inch caliper tree. They don't struggle, but it takes time, and then they have to charge you a lot of money.
So do you guys sell potted service berries there at the Arboretum?
We do. And it's a hot ticket, Stephanie. And you know, a lot of times when I get them in, they're gone within a couple of weeks. Right. And people are like, well, why don't you get more? And sometimes it's all I can get. You know, let's put it this way. I think I have three left, and I'm amazed I have three left of the shad blows.
Well, I'd imagine after today, those three shad blow are going to be gone. I hope so for you guys that you get them sold. But yeah, it's kind of cool, because we keep talking about Kay Young, and I actually still do not own that book. And I have to go get it now. It's ridiculous. We've talked about it so many times, and some of the recipes sound really, really cool. So I'm going to have to get that. Making this stuff. Next year is going to be the year, I think. I think we are starting my bucket list, but hopefully it's not like, maybe I'll recall my next year's wish list or something instead of bucket list, because I just want to start making all this stuff. Sounds so cool.
Yeah. And I think, again, like you said, everybody's busy, and it's like, A lot of people find time to walk the dog that night, but maybe that walking the dog is driving the dog to a wild area that you can go foraging, right? At the same time, or maybe your route includes. I think what foraging teaches you is to be observant, because you wouldn't be looking for this stuff if you weren't foraging it, right? So you just kind of go through life, you know, maybe walking the dog, looking at your dang phone at the same time, right? You know, that can rather than checking to see what you can harvest next.
Yeah. Well, I mean, gardening kind of does that for us, doesn't it? It kind of teaches you to really stop and really experience and really look and really examine.
Yep.
It's kind of the slowing down of motions where you're actually able to be in it and feel like you're in it and be like, wait a second, this is a whole new way of experiencing things. So I like adding the foraging element in. And I mean, I guess I haven't been foraging for food stuff up to this point so much, but I have been going out and harvesting plant material, like seed saving, and, you know, going out and cutting some flowers for vases, and just also just going out to kind of see, okay, how much pollinator activity is this plant getting? So I think I'm getting there now. I just need to get out and take stuff to cook with instead of keep spending all this outrageous money buying food all the time when I have plenty of food stuff in my own garden. It's just the fact of matter of learning about it and then actually going out and harvesting it when it's ready. So I am getting inspired from this. And if no one else is, then at least we are. You know, you're going to go out and maybe get your wine food stuff and make your wife happy. And I'm maybe gonna be able to get inspired to go out and do some stuff. So, well, this has been fun. As long as you want to do a plant series with me, I am happy to keep running one because it's exciting stuff.
Awesome. So, awesome. Yeah. You bet. Count on it.
Well, sounds fun. Cool, cool. I had fun today. Thanks for chatting with me again.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to the Plant Native Nebraska podcast. If you need notes on anything mentioned in today's episode, check our website, plant-native-nebraska.captivate.fm for more info. I want you to know you've made this podcast special just by listening in, but if you found real value in today's talk, you can both financially support future episodes and dive deeper into the topics we share by finding us on Patreon at patreon.com/plantnativenebraska. Thanks for listening.